Welcome to this seminar, which is organized under the auspices of the Rust Change Project, which is financed by the PetroSAM 2 program of the Research Council of Norway. My name is Indra Øverland, and I work here at NUPI. And today we have two presentations about sanctions and the Russian petroleum sector. The first presentation will be by Louis Skiner, who is an old colleague of mine from NUPI from many years ago, who has also worked for Statoil for several years, including in Moscow, and currently works for Clifford Chance, a law firm in Moscow. And the second presentation will be by Daniel Fjærtoft, who is part of the Rust Change Project, has also been at NUPI many, many years ago for a briefer period, and is one of the founding partners of Sigra Group, which works, which specializes in the Russian petroleum sector. We will start with Louis' presentation, and then we will go straight to Daniel's presentation. And afterwards, Arild Moe, who is the leader of the Rust Change Project and former director of Fridtjof Nansen Institute and senior research fellow there, will give some comments on the presentations. And after that, we will open for questions and discussion with the audience. So first, Louis.
Thank you very much, Indra. I hope everyone can hear me. Well, thank you for the invitation. Some of you may remember I was here in September last year giving a presentation on sanctions. And one of the main questions was, how bad will it be? Well, for those of you who went to Anders Oslund's presentation this morning, you'll think it's an absolute disaster. What I'm going to say actually is going to complement a lot of what he says, but I'm going to hopefully paint a more nuanced picture. And that primarily is because I represent a law firm in Moscow. For those of you who know Clifford Chance, we're a London-based firm who have our reputation because of our work with finance institutions. We represent the big Western banks and the big Russian banks. So we have to survive, and one of the ways we are surviving now is we're working on projects where money is coming from different sources, and you can probably all guess where, and we'll touch on that in the presentation as well. I thought we'd start by looking at, you know, as Osland did indeed this morning, the sort of the key figures and why the slowdown we've seen over the last year should not, as the Russian government portray it to be seen as a result of sanctions. Clearly there was a number of structural issues that have been exacerbated by sanctions, and I think that's important to emphasize. The second thing we're going to try and do is differentiate between the impact of the oil price and sanctions. This is really a double whammy for the Russian economy in that it suffered both from a slip in the oil price and sanctions simultaneously. But I think it's important to understand their impact. And why we use the word current and future productions is because I think one relates more to current production and the other to future production, i.e. production after 2020, when current reserves are depleted. We're going to look at the US and US and EU financial sanctions and look at their impact on different sorts of financing. You hear in many presentations, as we did this morning, references generally to financing. Well, obviously the financial world is more complicated than that, and there are many different sources of financing available to corporates and to banks. And what we'll try and do is give you a flavor of where the impact has gone, because the different sorts of financing are used for different sorts of activities. I think that's very, very important when you look at the oil and gas sector. You don't get project financing for exploration work because no one wants to take the risk. And similarly, you need project financing for development and production of a project because it's going to cost you $20, $30 billion. So the different role of different players, what we'll look at in the third section. We'll look at M&A activity, and then we'll look finally, I think, very interesting development is the way in which the move towards China has obviously been accelerated, but it's also become more complicated. Because obviously the Chinese understand the Russians need money, which gives them more to negotiate with. And having been in Beijing a couple of times over the last 6 weeks, it's very, very interesting to see that play now in terms of perspective. The Chinese are happy to sit there for the next 6 months, and the Russians need something signed by Victory Day when the Chinese president turns up in Moscow. So it's an interesting dynamic. Structural slowdown. Point two, Silyanov, the Minister of Finance, he's tried to estimate how much the decline in oil prices and the sanctions have cost the Russian economy. Well, of course, the impact is much, much greater than the actual figures because of the slowdown in domestic production. It was already down to 1.3% growth in 2013. You saw flat growth in 2014, and now we're expecting a contraction of 3, 4, 5%. It's anyone's guess. Why is this? Well, obviously, you've got lower export revenues, increased capital flow, very, very important. And it's the third point we're going to focus on today, which is the interruption in international lending. I think we dwell on the word liquidity. It was interesting in the Auslan talk today. He basically suggested Russia was insolvent, which it's not. Russia is not insolvent. And indeed, you know, Russian corporates and Russian banks are desperate to pay off foreign debt. They want to be solvent because they don't want to be caught in this exchange rate cycle where it's very, very difficult for them to calculate their liabilities. But what we are seeing is an increasing liquidity crisis. And when I mean the liquidity crisis, I mean the access to money is being restricted. And that's what's very, very important going forward. Oil price slide and its consequences on current production. So obviously the revenue Russia realizes from oil exports and refined products has declined 6% in ruble terms year on year. But as we see in the second bullet point, for most major Russian producers, the decline in oil prices and the fall in the ruble-dollar exchange rate have offset each other. And the reason is that if you're a Rosneft or a Lukoil or a Sorgutneftegaz, most of your costs are denominated in rubles. So your cost base has actually shrunk considerably. If you look at some of the larger fields, they have a break-even cost of $7 a barrel. And I think on average, you're talking roughly about $25 a barrel for an onshore conventional field in Russia, which is almost as low as the Arab states. So when you look at current production, it's not being impacted. And that's what we've seen, is the fact that year-on-year production actually increased last year, and certainly for the first quarter it hasn't dipped. And the impact of key free cash flow, obviously, it's very, very important for Russian producers to keep producing. The question is, what do they do for their capex? What are they doing for their capital investment? And that's what we're going to look at in the next slide, because this is where the sanctions do hit. We've talked about this before in my last presentation. You've probably had a number of people stand up here and talk about the new projects between Rosneft, Statoil, Eni, ExxonMobil. Well, those projects that were signed up in 2012, 2013, they were initiated because the Russian government understood it needed to get access to its Arctic offshore and to develop onshore tight oil reserves. And it needed not just Western financing, but experience and technology to do that. And that's where we see the real impact, in the fact that the sanctions that have been imposed, both financial and the export controls, are stopping the export of technology and services needed for that exploration. It's something we've been working on actively for the last 9 months for Rosneft to try and get the authorizations necessary from Luxembourg, because all these project operators are established in Luxembourg, for them and their partners to import into Russia equipment and technical services, and they haven't got them yet. So this is going to have an impact on future production. And then, of course, we come to the financial sanctions, which is what we're going to talk about for the rest of the presentation, because it's the financial restrictions, and you can already see this. They are clearly impacting on the ability of Rosneft and Novatek, people forget about Novatek, to raise financing. What are the financial sanctions? Well, I won't go through these slides in too much detail. I've included it so you have something to take away with you. But you have both US and EU financial sanctions. The US ones are basically restricting US persons transacting or providing finance of longer than 90-day maturity period with listed entity. And you can see the listed entities are Rosneft, Novatek, Transneft, and Gazpromneft. 90 days, well, for those of you who are not familiar with financial markets, I mean, a lot of loans are of less than a 90-day maturity period. But if you're talking about developing projects in the Kara Sea on the basis of project financing, obviously you're talking about a lot longer than a 90-day maturity period. And, you know, the typical expectation would be that a project in the Arctic would get at least 60% project financing. Project financing is used for many reasons. I think the most important one, if you represent the foreign partner, is because it disciplines your Russian partner. If you're financing the project off your own balance sheet, then obviously it's harder to use mechanisms to control the way in which the project's developed. If you've got banks involved, first of all, you need discipline in terms of your documentation, and secondly, the bank's going to be very, very demanding about how that project is operated and the revenue flows. And that's why, typically, the Statoils and Exxons want to get project financing, because it means they've got a mother-in-law in the room who's going to tell Rosneft how to behave itself. So this sanction basically precludes the provision of project financing. And we see the same with the EU sanction. You have a similar sanction introduced on purchasing, selling, dealing in transferable securities market instruments with an maturity exceeding 30 days. It's interesting, on this score, the EU sanction is much, much tougher than the US sanction. They've got talking about a maturity period of 30 days. So this has basically stopped all interbank lending, which means that the Russian banks, the state banks, we haven't mentioned them expressly in this presentation, but the likes of VTB, Sberbank, VEB, Gazprom Bank, who are all included in the sanctions, all listed, they can no longer go to European banks and US banks and get loans. Neither can the energy companies, because they're also listed. So this really does suffocate them in terms of their access to financing. We then have, and this is an interesting, at least from a practical perspective, provision in the European sanction that talks again about providing credit up to 30 days and introduces various exceptions. Financing for non-prohibited imports or exports, emergency funding, and as you can see in the second section, it just gives the criteria for when these exceptions should be applied. I think one of the interesting differences between the US and the EU sanctions is the US sanctions, they are effective from the date they're published. So if we take the export controls, they were published on the 6th of August. That means that if it's not on a ship on its way to Russia, it's not going. Because if you need to get a license under the export administration regulations, there's a presumption of denial. It's the irony of the US regulation. It says that in these circumstances, you need to get a license, and by the way, we're not going to give you one. The EU sanctions, of course, were fudged because of all the vested interests in Europe, and it created a hole whereby if you have a framework agreement or an agreement that creates obligations signed before the 1st of August, which is when the initial sanctions were introduced, then you can apply to the competent authorities of the member state in which you're registered to get the appropriate authorization. And it's this loophole that obviously Statoil and Eni and Rosneft are trying to exploit, because they are saying, well, all our risk service agreements, all our framework agreements were signed in 2013, so therefore we can run a whole project on the basis of the fact that we had an existing agreement. And you see a similar exemption in the wording for the financial sanction. We're going to look at some of the consequences in practice, because the problem is that these sanctions are drafted primarily for the banking sector. And the types of loans and the types of arrangements concluded between energy companies for financing don't have the precise terms that are needed to qualify for exemptions. If you see here, you have to include provisions regarding the length of the repayment period, drawdowns, disbursements, interest rates, calculation methods. Typically, the loan agreements that are used to carry finance exploration projects, say where Statoil will agree with Rosneft to carry finance all its exploration projects, it won't have included this detail. And therefore, it doesn't qualify for the exemption. So this is why the energy sector has been badly hit. What's the impact? Well, a lot of people talk now about Rosneft's outstanding foreign debt. 28 billion rubles, US dollars, sorry, they wish it was rubles, is due to be repaid in the next 2 years. Well, we've already seen that Rosneft has a lot of free cash flow because its production costs have dropped. It's got a lot of producing assets, so it's got money. The other interesting thing is it received $68 billion in 2010 because of the prepayment contracts it concluded with CNPC. That amount is actually open to dispute because Rosneft hasn't been able to expand the infrastructure in order to deliver the quantities that CNPC agreed to. So CNPC are actually reducing the payments, but they've clearly got enough money from the prepayment contracts and free cash flow to cover short-term existing obligations. So people who tell you that Rosneft are going to go bankrupt, that's just not the case. They won't. What is interesting, we've seen this because this is the sort of work we would typically do, is that the trading houses like Vitol, Trafigura, who would have pre-financed a lot of Rosneft's work, they're not able to. And the reason is simple, is that even though if we go back to the exemption in the sanction, even though you're allowed to provide financing for export of goods, it's clear that when you pre-finance something, you're not simply financing the export of the oil. You're actually giving them basically a working capital facility, which they're going to use in general. So the common position now is that you cannot conclude prepayment arrangements with Rosneft. And that's exactly what they've been doing for the last 5 years with BP, with CNPC, with Vitol, with Trafigura, with Gunvor. That has been the way they have been financing their development. So that avenue is no longer open to them. Impact on E&P activity, exploration and production activity. We've just mentioned this, that the foreign partners of Rosneft typically use EU entities to finance their activity with Rosneft. So the normal structure would be, if you take the Statoil project, you'd have a project operator established in Luxembourg, which doesn't have an interest in the license, but is going to develop the field that is subject to the license under a risk service arrangement. And both Rosneft and Statoil, because it's tax efficient in terms of transfer of funds, would set up Dutch holding companies in order to invest money into that Luxembourg company as a shareholder. And this is the same for the Chinese as well. It's the same across the board. The reason is actually quite simple. It's because the Dutch have the best bilateral tax treaty with Russia in terms of withholding tax. The irony of history, of course, is that 160 Dutch citizens were on MH17. So which national authorities are the least likely in Europe to grant authorizations in accordance with the sanctions? Because in order to finance your operations in Russia, you would have to get permission in Holland to issue shareholder loans or loans either to the operator in Luxembourg or directly to Rosneft. So again, this is another illustration of how actually the financial sanctions are really, really biting on the ability to fund activity. Then this is the $64 million question for Statoil, for Exxon, and for Eni, is that the carry financing arrangements that they drafted in 2013, whereby they sort of make a equity injection. It's not really a loan, and it doesn't have drawdown periods. It doesn't have clear repayment dates. It's a sort of working capital facility to allow Rosneft to develop the project through to the first exploration well or the appraisal well, whatever it is. These agreements, they are also subject to sanctions. Of course, the argument is that they were signed before 1st of August 2014, and therefore future drawdowns aren't subject to the sanctions. But the European law is quite clear. If the drawdown doesn't contain precise information as to repayment period, maximum amount, etc., then it is caught. So even the intercompany facilities that have been agreed are actually, in theory, restricted. I don't know what the position of these companies are on them, but certainly our advice and the advice of most lawyers in Moscow would be you would be a foolish man to be continuing to draw down from your carry finance agreement. Unless, of course, you take out the Dutch holding company and you would do it from Norway, because then it would be the Norwegian authorities who would be basically thrown the hot potato. If you threw it to the Dutch authorities, you know exactly how the Dutch authorities would react to it. M&A activity. Now, this is interesting because what do Rosneft do? Well, Rosneft have to find some way of accessing money in order to generate capex, capital investments. So where do they go? Well, they go to the Chinese, and they say to the Chinese, why don't you buy 49% of Vancor? The Chinese say, fine, we'll buy 49% of Vancor. They say, actually, no, we're not going to sell you 49% of Vancor. We're going to issue new shares, because we don't really want to give you 49%, but what we do is we need your money. European sanctions, issuing any money market instrument, which would include a share, transferable security, with a maturity exceeding 30 days, is prohibited. So this sort of typical structure a Rosneft would use in a transaction, an M&A transaction, in order to access additional money from the company that's purchasing part of their project, is not open. And that's why, for those of you who've been following the story of Vancor hasn't happened. Because why? Well, CNPC used Dutch holding companies to make all investments in Russia because of the bilateral tax treaty. And CNPC, like other companies, don't want to set up joint ventures in Singapore or Hong Kong because Hong Kong and Singapore don't have the same bilateral tax treaties. So even the Asian companies who are being encouraged to invest into Russia are being caught in the same trap, that the restrictions prohibit the types of structures that are typically used. And this is why, in conclusion, you know, I think it's pretty safe to say that it's accelerating Russia's move east, but it's actually complicating Russia's move east. We all know the story. 2008, Russia realizes it can't be dependent upon European buyers. It needs to rethink its energy strategy, market diversification, you know, Asian markets, LNG. Everyone knows this story. But if you actually look now at where those projects are, and we'll do this on the next slide, you will begin to see quite how the sanctions have impacted on that relationship. 2014, June or May, 30-year gas supply deal, CNPC, the power of Siberia, lots of trumpet blowing and noise in Moscow about new strategic alliances. As Anders Oslund said this morning, where's the $25 billion that the CNPC promised in prepayment financing? They provided it to Rosneft for the ESPU expansion. They haven't provided it yet for the power of Siberia. There's now talk about the Altai pipeline as an alternative. But everybody understands that you will hit the same issue. And the issue basically is that the Chinese understand that, one, it's very, very difficult to set the price of gas, because gas is typically indexed to a basket of carbon products, one of which is oil. And two, you know, they hold all the cards in negotiations. And when we've been in Peking, as I said, last couple of months, their attitude is, well, we can sit here till, you know, until Christmas if you want. Whereas the Russians are clearly desperate and increasingly desperate to get money on the table. LNG. Well, this is where you see the biggest impact of financial sanctions, because, you know, typically LNG projects are very capital intensive. For those of you who know about Stockmann, I mean, the last estimates when Statoil exited Stockmann was the capex would be something like $55 billion. So these aren't cheap projects. Of course, normally in an LNG project, because the price is so high, the volumes are committed beforehand. So before you make an FID, a financial investment decision, you've already found your buyers and you've concluded contracts with them. But what's happening in the world now? Well, you've got two things. You've got the collapse in the oil price, which is, if those of you have been following the LNG price, which is based on the JCC, the Japan Crude Cocktail, has halved in the last 3-4 months. And you've got the sanctions that are restricting your access to go to banks and raise projects financing. So this is why, for example, Yamal LNG, whose majority shareholder is Novatek, so they're therefore caught by sanctions, has to find $19 billion in project financing in order to continue the project. Rosneft wouldn't be able to get project financing, so it's not even an issue for them. But what it means is that, you know, at least two elements of Russia's rethink, i.e. focusing on Asia and diversifying, are in big trouble. And a lot of people would question whether or not they're actually going to happen. And then oil. Well, clearly oil, you know, is always going to be important. And the Asian routes are more and more important for Russia. If you look at the comparative export last year, there was increasing refocus to Asia, and that's set to continue over the next 15 years. But, you know, as with the gas issue, replacing dependency on Europe by China is just as dangerous a game, in the sense that you have pricing pressure on Asian markets, you have the availability of additional supplies from other producers, and demand is growing much more slowly than had been expected, because Chinese GDP is slowing down. So even on the oil front, Russia's strategy is now being questioned. So what are the common concerns we see in practice? Well, certainly if you look at the international companies, are increasingly sensitive to the challenges that Russia is facing. One of the reasons why so many big deals were signed up to in 2013 was that the Russian government changed its tax legislation in order to basically make any offshore project free of export duty and at a minimal mineral extraction tax. Well, clearly now, as the Russian budget is receiving a lot less money because it's earning a lot less money from the sale of oil and gas, the temptation, of course, would be to increase tax. And any increase in those tax is going to push these projects' NPV below the threshold needed to keep Western companies interested in it. I mean, it's already marginal. So, I mean, any increase in tax would destroy the project economics for a Statoil or an ExxonMobil. This is, of course, an academic discussion because they need $85 a barrel anyhow to make these projects marginal. But if you add an increased tax rate, you're already in big trouble. Currency conversion. This is something that's, you know, I think the Russian government are very, very conscious of going there, and actually they've been quite disciplined, and they have expressly refused to even consider it. Because once you start introducing capital flows, that's when all the money's going to leave Russia. They haven't done it yet, but if you look at the fact now that every month you have this cycle in the exchange rate, why is there a cycle? Well, it's because the big state-owned companies are being sat on by the government in order to convert their dollar earnings into rubles to hit the deadline for tax payments. So this is actually one of the things that on a monthly basis is keeping the ruble at, what, 51, 52 a dollar now. The other thing, and this is one of the reasons our business has so been badly impacted, is that Russian companies now just want to use Russian law because they don't see a reason to use English law. Why would you use English law? Well, you typically use English law because you have to go to a bank and say, please finance our project, because as you can see, the risks are allocated in a way that will mean it's going to actually work. So the English law is the ingredient you need in order to access financing. If you can't go to foreign banks, then why are you going to use English law? Increasingly now, a lot of work is being done under Russian law. But even the Chinese find that, you know, frightening in the sense that if you have a Russian law-governed shareholder agreement, you have to go to a Russian court in the event of a dispute. So if you have a dispute with Rosneft or Gazprom or Gazpromneft, you're in a Russian court. You could, well, you, it doesn't even, you, I don't even to, need, need to illustrate the concern. Yeah, and the last couple of issues, I guess they're quite technical, but the idea is really to show that if you were to use the sort of risk matrix that any company in the world or any major oil and gas company would apply to a project, it was always difficult, I remember from my Statoil days, to get enough ticks in order to justify the project to go forward. Now you wouldn't get one tick because of all the reasons we've been through today. And that's it, yeah. So it's as gloomy as Auslan's presentation, but the reality is actually, if you look at the way in which the sanctions have been worded, if you look at the clear intent of the regulators to ensure that they are complied with, then it means, as Auslan said, nobody is willing to lend Russia a dollar anymore. Okay.
Thank you very much, Louis, for providing a really insightful perspective. Having lived in Moscow for the last 6 years or so and really been on the inside of a lot of these things. And also a real insight on the inside of a mind of a lawyer. And what I saw was there was a lot of complex text there. Now we will have Daniel's presentation, which I think he's an economist, so I expect it to look a little bit different. And he's going to talk specifically about the impact of sanctions on oil production, which I think is an important question, not just for Russia, but also for the world and for Norway, as Russia is the world's second biggest oil exporter.
Okay, am I on? Hello, thank you for having me. I'm here to present a very fresh report that I've been working on together with Indra through the Petrosum 2 program, financed by the Norwegian Research Council, within the Risk Change project, where we look at changes going on institutionally in the Russian oil sector. But with the current game-changing events, we found it interesting to also look into the effect of sanctions. And my objective here today is to try and illustrate for you how the sanctions could impact Russian oil production and also in what particular way. As Louis was also talking about, as of approximately July 2014, the EU and the US became aligned in terms of sector sanctions for the Russian economy. Focusing on finance, energy, and defense. This is to make it short. The EU, in its justification, is focused on its moral obligation to react following the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight, being sorry to hurt. And the US has been much more frank, saying that the whole intention is to inflict an economic cost on the Russian government and Russian economy for its actions in the Ukraine. There is one big question that if this hurt is inflicted, will this hurt help? Unfortunately, this is something that one will have to think about beyond the seminar. I think one of the discussions that been dominating is in so far as that the presumption that sanctions or damage to the Russian economy will help. There are some people will argue that they do, others will argue that they don't. But in general terms, just to recap what Louis was saying, the export ban on equipment precludes export of equipment going to deep water exploration and production projects, offshore Arctic, and shale oil production. On the finance side, state banks and key oil companies have been targeted, which importantly in our case means that as we were saying, Rosneft cannot borrow money abroad anymore. And also, the Russian banks cannot borrow the money for Rosneft and issue it to them, which leaves the Russian state as sort of the last option. And if we look at energy's share in the Russian economy, if you want to inflict damage, the energy sector seems very much the right thing to target. Equally so, in terms of oil production, the state-owned companies which are under sanctions, Rosneft and Gazpromneft, together, through their jointly owned subsidiary Slavneft, control more than 50% of Russian oil production. So the Russian policy that has been underway throughout the 2000s of increasing the role of the state in the Russian petroleum sector have now had the final consequence that about 50% of Russian oil production is conducted by oil companies under sanctions. However, the impact so far is not easy to identify. Monthly Russian oil production has stayed pretty much on trend up until March, end of March 2015. This doesn't mean that it won't fall or could decline. And already in 2010, and it was reiterated in 2011, the Ministry of Energy voiced concern that unless specific measures were taken, Russian oil production would start to decline more or less immediately. And the recipe for avoiding sort of the low case scenario here and sticking in the high case was tax breaks, specifically relating to the export duty and mineral extraction tax. As you also see here from the that production has initially stuck or been in track with the high case scenario for the first part of years, in the last couple of years, been slightly below. So recently, a draft energy strategy for towards 2035 has come out, where they sort of continue this projection of current production levels with a slight growth, stating, which differs from the Ministry of Energy's first outlook, saying that, well, we won't have that big peak around 2018, 2019, but we will also not have the dip. In any case, in order to avoid this decline, which the ministry at the time was warning could happen already in 2010, the ministry lined up a what some people call a pipeline, but a development schedule of fields that would have to come into production. And here we have, as this was issued before 2010, you have the Pirezlomnoy field, which came into production in 2013, Lukoil's Filanovskoy field, and several others, which were sort of spread out in time. Come sanctions, however, we see that approximately 12 of the 19 fields in the government's pipeline are affected by either financial or equipment bans on sanctions. Of the fields in the pipeline, there's only the Shell Gazprom Salym one that I have been able to identify as being directly hit by shale oil sanctions. There are two offshore fields in our chart, but as I said, Pirezlomnoy came on stream already, and Lukoil's Filanovskoy field is shallow water. So presumably, these are not hit. Of course, this development schedule is in no way exhaustive, because there are a countless number of fields that could be developed. But this is sort of the ministry's vision of what had to come on stream in order to avoid a decline in 2012. And now, coincidentally, the four largest fields here, which are under sanction, question, will they be developed? And in total now, we have about 70%. 5% of the planned resources from this pipeline, are under question. And as Louis was talking about, there's a big interest in, will Rosneft be able to finance the capital expenditure necessary to push this pipeline ahead? Because 10 of these 19 projects are Rosneft projects, which is makes it the company a considerable player also in future going forward. If we look at the debt repayment schedule of Rosneft, we just see here that they One of the reasons Rosneft is so big is that it acquired TNK BP in 2013, which has left it with the left the company with a large debt. And some 23 or something billion US dollars are due to be repaid in 2015. So if we try to add up what Rosneft has to pay to service its debt and what Rosneft potentially would have to pay in order to stay on track with its development plan, we can get our bar on the far left here of our chart, assuming it's the 2014 investment level. Of course, free income is not sufficient to finance to cover all these costs, the EBITDA box there. And well, where to get the rest of the money? As we were talking about, since outside financing is blocked, the government is the sort of the obvious place to call. And Rosneft has filed an application for 1.3 billion trillion rubles in order to finance this development. It was initially at one point reported to be around 2 trillion rubles, which was promptly declined because this money is supposed to come from the National Welfare Fund, which is one of Russia's two sovereign wealth funds. And at the point in time, depending on the ruble exchange rate, somewhere in the vicinity of 3 trillion rubles. So then Rosneft was essentially asking for 2/3 of this bag of money to finance its pipeline. This was denied, and the Russian government now is in negotiations, and it was out of this 1.3 trillion ruble application, signals are, reports are, that Rosneft could probably expect something in the area of 300 billion rubles. So subtracting that from our required capital and adding Rosneft's warned 30% cut in capital expenditure for 2015, we still have a big gap that in some way or the other would have to be filled. And my intention is not sort of to say that Rosneft will go bankrupt. This isn't the point. The point is more to illustrate that going forward, finance is going to be a big challenge for the company. And of the two choices, investment in new production and servicing old debt, there's going to have to be some sort of trade-off between these two. And Rosneft has acknowledged this as well and signaled already that two large fields, the Ruskoye from our pipeline and Yuburechna-Tahomskoye, which is the largest, will be postponed. If we add one more field for which Gazprom Neft has applied for financing from the same welfare fund, so we can assume that if it's applying for financing, there must be some trouble, and it's likely that the project will be postponed. Then we can add this up together here in this chart, which sort of shows, on the one hand, the plan from 2012 of how these fields are going to come into production and support the total Russian oil production, and sort of with the area graph behind it showing what the new plan is. And in total, the gray area here represents the postponed production that one thought one could expect, but which is not going to come on stream as initially planned. And obviously, this is going to have some impact on total Russian oil production, which is illustrated here. That rather large area of postponed production in the previous slide is, of course, large in the context of three fields, somewhat smaller in the context of total Russian oil production, but nonetheless, of course, significant. So we sort of see here below is our checkered area is the ministry's decline scenario. And then going on the way top of all our things, all our graphs, is the energy strategies target production. So we sort of see that of this production that one expected would come in addition to what is to replace the decline, then some 370 million barrels of oil will be postponed, leading to a dip in Russian oil production, maybe in the vicinity, using just these numbers, around 2%, reaching a minimum in 2018. This is, of course, using numbers available. It's using but numbers that have been made available from the Ministry of Energy and combining them with Rosneft's postponement schedule. Of course, there's one issue in my mind with this chart. It is that the chart assumes that production will climb back to target quite rapidly once these three fields reach their target plateau production level. And one might argue that this is entirely possible. One can also argue that, well, if you were planning to develop a certain amount or had the capacity to develop a certain amount of new field at any given point in time, if you then didn't do it in the past, how are you going to be able to do what you didn't do in the past and what you were planning to do initially at the same time, which is essentially what you'd have to do in order to climb? So that's why before I conclude my presentation, I'd just like to throw out a food-for-thought scenario for you where Rosneft focuses on developing these three fields and sticks to its renewed schedule, but has to sacrifice all other capital expenditure and its share of replacing resources for this time period. The consequence then is that rather than having a short decline or a temporary decline and climbing back up, is that Russian oil production could go into a long-term decline and falling down to about 7% below 2014 levels by 2025. This is coincidentally in line with some of the predictions made by officials in the Russian oil sector. But it's also the one graph that is based, that is made the most freedom, I would say, out of the limited information available. But I think that realistically, we would probably be somewhere in between the first production outlook with a limited dip and then recovery, and a more long-term period of reduced production. Just to mention one important thing is that in order to avoid the scenario, which given the importance of Russian oil production to the Russian state and the importance of Rosneft to Russian oil production, one will have to find money in some way or the other to avoid this scenario. And although it is hard for us from the outside to sort of point to the obvious sources of such financing, we have to be prepared that this could happen. The Vancouver deal is for some 10% framework agreement. Of course, it may be in trouble. This there has also been talk about the Chinese investing in the refurbishment of 100 wells in Ingushetia or something. These things could materialize, but are hard to put into numbers and put into graphs. Another obvious option is that the Russian government's reluctance to issue 1.3 trillion rubles from the National Welfare Fund could be rejected by the presidential level, because and that would actually fit quite well with the pattern we've seen before, where the government is in some way less enthusiastic about Rosneft, wanting to privatize, wanting to limit access to license, but where such things have been trumped at the very top. And I think going forward, this will be a very interesting development to see what happens to Rosneft's application for funding. There's a lot of arguments being put forward that we need this funding or production will drop. And on that note, I'd just like to conclude saying that financial sanctions are the ones have a clear impact and are probably the ones that have the most impact in the short to midterm, predominantly because Russian oil production to such a degree hinges on Rosneft as the dominant player. And even though Rosneft can endure low prices with operating expenditure in the vicinity of $5 per barrel, capital expenditure average in the vicinity of $5 per barrel, the company could, in a sanctions-free world, probably ride this off quite easily by attracting funding from other sources. This door is, seems at the moment to be closed. So then the question is, how will Rosneft manage both repaying its debts and investing the amounts needed for Russian oil production to stay on track and not dip? We have put forward two potential scenarios how we can look at this, but I think it's important to bear in mind that although Rosneft is very important and Rosneft is under sanction, it's not the only company. And Lukoil as well, for example, has warned that it will be cutting back capital investments in 2015. And following the reasoning behind the preceding two graphs, this will also have an impact on Russian oil production. So thank you very much for your attention, and looking forward to the discussion to come.
Thank you very much, Daniel. If you have any comments or questions, please remember them. Because first to comment is going to be the real expert, Arjen Moe from Fridtjof Nansen Institute.
I think we have understood that there are some very good experts on these issues in this room, and certainly not among them. Thank you both, Luis and Daniel, for very, very interesting and detailed analysis. I won't repeat I think you said. I learned a lot from getting these more legal insights, which I think are extremely important because they also show how countries and actors who are not participating in the sanction are also very, very heavily affected. And certainly your analysis on the development of oil production is extremely interesting. And I think it's very important to get this time perspective on developments, that sanctions have an effect, but they have a different effect over time. And certainly there is a lot of inertia in Russia, which we should always remember. It's a huge, huge machine. And even if technological embargoes have been implemented, it will take time before it makes themselves felt, because there is a lot of equipment already at hand. So in one, two, three years, things may look different if sanctions are continuing. I would just like to add some observations on the political framework here. As you pointed out, Luis, it's really methodologically a little bit difficult to distinguish between different explanations for what's going on. Basically, there are three groups of explanations. One is, as you said, sort of the fundamental economic problems in Russia and unresolved reforms. Then you have the oil price, of course, and you have the sanctions. And there have been some attempts at weighing these things. I think it's interesting to note, if you follow the discourse, now there is a discourse on this in the Russian media. I think it's pretty close in a way to what you are saying. There is an understanding that the sanctions are not the main problem. In fact, the Ministry of Economic Development said it straight out. Among these three reasons or explanations, the biggest problem is our own policy. I mean, that's the Minister of Economic Development saying that. So if the sanctions are lifted, all the problems won't go away, but they certainly add to the situation. In the sort of preliminary draft of a new energy strategy in Russia, which has been underway for some time, it's quite clear, and it's been put into numbers, the importance of new sources of oil in the years to come to offset the decline in producing fields. So by 2035, quite a lot is expected to come from untraditional sources, 80 million tons, in fact, 50% from the continental shelf, and 47 from other new traditional fields. And all these additions are clearly very much affected by the sanctions. So if the sanctions continue, Russia is in for a very, I would say, a very, very difficult future.